Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the mega city metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony. Thank you for tuning in to this episode, and it's a real special one because I have none other than legendary, prolific comic book scribe, Mr. Fabian Nicieza. If you guys remember a couple road reports ago, I did a whole solo episode talking about how much I love the Deadpool and Cable series, and lo and behold, I have the man himself visiting the cave to talk about some of the highlights in his career and some of the things he's working on currently. And of course, through the going back in time to reading some of the things that I had never read before from Fabian, fell down this X-Men rabbit hole because of him, and now in my current reading, I've caught up to the point where I'm at that Fatal Attractions precipice that I was setting myself up for, and we're going to have an episode discussing that whole storyline with a special guest that you guys have had on the, heard on the show before. So I'm looking forward to setting all those things up. There's a lot of things coming up in the future for the Cave of Solitude as the new year rolls around. We're going to have a lot of things to discuss and some guests that I'm setting up to come onto the show. So we're looking forward to that. And remember to rate and review us on iTunes. Leave us an email at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Instagram. All of that good stuff. And spread the word if you hear an episode that you enjoy. Hit me up. Let me know that you enjoy it or something that you want to hear or discuss. Because, you know, this is a podcast for the people, if you will. So without further ado, I hope you guys enjoy this conversation that I was able to have. It was super easy to talk to him. He answered all the questions that I had in my head and some of the ones that I had written down. And it was just an absolute blast. So again, thanks to Fabian Nicieza for coming on to the show. So without further ado, Cave of Solitude, Eric Anthony signing out. I hope you guys enjoy the episode. Stay tuned for more good things coming to you guys soon. Welcome, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude. We are happy for this episode to have one of comics' most prolific and successful writers join the show for the first time. He's got an extensive greatest hits list. He's the co-creator of one of pop culture's most recognizable characters, not created by Stan Lee. Yes, we're talking about Deadpool. It's the one and only Fabian Nicieza. Welcome to the show, Fabian. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Why is it a cave of solitude? Why can't we have friends over in our cave?
You know, it's funny. Ron Friends asked the same thing. He says, it's so sad. What a sad name.
It is. It's a little sad. I don't want to. And yet we're in it together. So therefore, it's not solitude because we're both not here.
You know,
it really should be a cave of friendship.
Right. It should be like the Hall of Friendship or something podcast. Yeah. It was actually started off as a comic book Instagram page to just like share comic book stuff with other guys in fandom, guys and girls in fandom. And it was a combination of the Batcave and the Fortress of Solitude. So gotcha. When the brain storming came for the podcast, I said, I'll just take what the Instagram page is because it's comic book related. But it is sad, and I've often thought about changing the name, believe me. But people say stick with it, so I say, all right, I'll stick with it.
Eric, the time will come to change the name when you're on it by yourself and you're not interviewing anybody.
Yeah, and so. There's been a couple episodes this year where I've just been on it by myself, so it's nice to have a friend come to the cave.
I'm here now. Where are the beers?
That's it.
I want to be 17 years old again. Where's the moose head?
That's right.
Since I'm up in Canada now.
That's right. You're watching the Jets game. You say it's not a good game right now, so maybe we'll have a little bit of fun talking about comic books.
It's always a good game if you're the Jets opponent.
It's kind of like playing the Leafs in the playoffs, I would say. You know you're going to get through them at some point.
It's a guaranteed pass to the next round. It might go seven games. They might tease you, but it's still going to go to the next round.
Yeah, exactly. God forbid we play Boston.
Oh, please, even the Rangers have trouble with Boston. So. Yeah.
So let's get started, Fabian. Let's go back to the beginning. I know you've been asked this question a ton of times, but I wanna ask what it was like for a 4 or 5 year old Fabian coming from Argentina and growing up in the tri-state area. What was adapting to the American culture like for you?
I gotta be honest. If I had struggles and when I had struggles adapting to learning the language. I was so young because I was only 4 years old that basically about a year of my life is a real blank. and that was mid-66 to mid-first grade in New York City. Very little snippets, and I didn't realize until I was a little older that really that was just my brain learning how to process speaking in English and thinking in English as opposed to Spanish. But from second grade on, I remember everything, and I never had any real problems. I mean, you know, my name was always a bit of an oddity, so people were always curious about that. But I was a pretty normal, acclimated suburban kid. I played a lot of sports. Did a lot of activities, caused a lot of trouble with my friends, avoided the police occasionally. So it was a pretty normal suburban upbringing. Mm-hmm. The differences usually came when I went over friends' houses, and parents were confused by my name or my nationality. If I'm out with my parents at a store or something and their accent is so heavy, especially when I was younger, and they struggled a lot more back then with the language than they did later in life. But that was always an awareness of a discomfort, an awareness that someone's looking at you a little bit like you're an other, you're an outsider. But it never really overtly affected me to the point where, you know, it was traumatic or nothing. I didn't get invited to some friends' parties, but that was just as much because I grew up in the apartments, not the houses, that kind of thing, you know?
Right.
So it's all good.
So
it's all good. Anything I drew from it, it turned into good fodder for my writing, more so than any kind of, you know, childhood trauma or anything like that.
Right. Which name did they have a hard time with? Because Fabian seems like a
pretty... No, Fabian was pretty easy, yeah. Especially the parents, because they all thought I was named after a singer in the 50s called Fabian Forte, who was popular for a couple of years, and he was a real big, hot, teeny bopper flame back then. Okay. So all my friends' parents were always like, "You're named after the singer?" I go, "No, I'm not named after the singer because I wasn't born in this country." It was my last name that's always been butchered. And I now live in New Jersey. I live in a very heavily Asian population, a lot of Chinese, Koreans, Indian, Pakistani where I live, and their names are harder to pronounce than my names. So my name was. So I hear my son and my daughter are able to pronounce Indian names like smoothly and easily because they've grown up among them, you know?
Right.
My name was just a little awkward. They didn't know what it was. Is it Italian? How do you know, Americans have a real hard time with vowels and consonants, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
They struggle to put the two things together. So I got a lot of Nkunza, a lot of Nichizi, a lot of stuff like that. Nkunza, they added extra N's. Oh, you know, so it was just let me put it this way. Whenever there was a substitute teacher doing roll call, I always knew when it was going to come to my name because they would just stop and panic.
Well, I'll be honest. When I always saw Nichizi in the comics, I always thought it was Italian. It sounded Italian
to me.
Yeah,
it's not Italian. It's Spanish. And you just pronounced it Italian before, but it's Spanish. It's actually, I made it my pinned tweet on Twitter just to have it there all the time. In Spanish, it's Fabian Nicieza. In English, it's Fabian Nicieza. And in American, it's Fabian Nkunza. but it's a Spanish name, possibly with some Arabic background to it too, because my father's side of the family derived from northern Spain, and that was heavily Moorish area.
Mm-hmm.
So you know it just is what it is. You know, my grandfather's from Spain, even though my dad was born in Argentina, and so was I.
Right. So I heard you say a few times on other podcasts that the relation that you had with comic books actually was one of the things that helped you learn to read in English.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yep, absolutely. My brother recognized Batman and Superman on the newsstand racks and the TV in Argentina before we moved here. They were showing the Batman serials from the 1940s on TV and the Superman TV show from the 50s on TV. So my brother would watch it. He's 3 years older, and I would just hang out next to him and watch 3 years old, 4 years old, you know. We recognized those. He asked my parents if we could buy them, and they weren't that expensive back then. Even though we didn't have much money when we first came here, they were 12 cents each. So if my parents were okay getting us one or two. And we just started to learn how to read. I think the words to picture combination probably enhanced tremendously our ability to create an understanding of what the English words meant. And as a result, I think we learned how to read and write English a lot faster. I never missed a grade. My brother, who was already, I think, in second grade when we started school in the U.S., didn't miss a grade either. He didn't get left back or nothing. We just went smoothly with all of it, you know? And I absolutely attribute that to comic books.
Yeah, and I've told a couple of my friends, I don't have kids myself, but a couple friends who do have kids, and they say, you know, I can't get my kid to read. They don't want to read any books. I said, give them comics, see what happens, because a lot of times that the picture with the words, they're still reading, and you'd be surprised how many, like your diction and your ability to be articulate increases by reading, just by reading, period. But even so, you know, people think comic books is like that low level, not really, you can't get anything out of it. But look at you and your brother and the effect it had on you guys, right? So there you go.
Yeah, I think all kids should want to be like me and my brother. Poor kids, we're going to just destroy an entire generation of children.
Or you could create some really awesome stuff, so you got to look at it both ways, right?
I guess. <Yeah. laughs> Sure, if you want to be optimistic, you're Canadian, so of course you're going to be optimistic.
So how early on did you know that you wanted to be a creative in the arts? Not necessarily comics, but
just I wanted to be a creative in the arts of comics from a very young age. My father was a sculptor. He was an engineer by trade, but he was a sculptor by heart. And he would sculpt clay environmental, you know, landscapes and cityscapes, and he would sculpt those in clay, and he would also sculpt clown faces in clay because he really liked clowns. And he encouraged us to draw when we started drawing. Both my brother and I drew, and we drew every single day. It wasn't probably till I was around 10 or 11 or so, 12, that I started drawing for the sake of developing a story. So the illustration was intended to either act out in really crude panel-to-panel format, or through collage imagery of whatever I was drawing, I'm developing story. And from that development, then I start fleshing story out more in my head. Then I went from fleshing it out in my head and drawing it to starting to write it. So I would try to do comic book pages that I'm hand lettering and drawing myself through my early teens. Then I really started to write prose work too. And I would write short stories, you know, a loose leaf paper, pencil or pen, short stories. And between freshman year in high school and sophomore year in high school, I wrote a 400-page loose leaf book. Wow. Front and back. So it was actually 200 pages of loose leaf front and back. I knew even then that I wanted to be a writer. Not necessarily an artist, because I think I even knew way back then that I just wasn't good enough. I was okay to put down on paper what I had in my mind, but I wasn't good enough to draw professionally. So my mind was really gravitating towards writing. And in high school, I tell the story a lot. In high school, I looked at the back cover photos of the authors on all the books I was reading, and all of them looked really, really old. They looked like they were in their mid-30s at least. So as a 14, 15-year-old, I said, oh, okay, I guess you got to be old to write. It doesn't just happen when you're young, so I better figure out how to get a job that lets me get a chance to write. So I went to college for communications, public relations, and advertising, hoping to get to write by doing promotion work, marketing work, and advertising work. And my first job out of college was working at Berkeley Publishing, which was a paperback book publisher. I was there for 2 years, and I was just about the point where I was ready to start showing the editors there some samples of my prose writing, with the goal of getting a chance to write some of their series novels. They had a spy series novel named Nick Carter, a couple Western series novels called Long Arm and Gunsmith. These books came out every month, and four, five, six different authors were writing the books. with the pseudonym on the cover, a blanket pseudonym on the cover. And they didn't pay much, but they gave you experience and they gave you opportunity. And if you're doing a good job, the editors get to know you and get to like your work. And then maybe they'll want to hear your pitch for your original book that you want to sell them. And I was just about maybe not even a month away from getting ready to start that process, because I'd been at Berkeley for 2 years, when I heard about the job opportunity at Marvel, and that's when I applied for a job at Marvel and got it. That was 1985.
So everything was going pretty much according to plan, it seems. Like you went to school
for it? Yeah, other than selling anything. Yeah, everything. But I interviewed at Marvel right out of college. I interviewed at DC and Marvel right out of college. I didn't get either job. More experienced people got them, deservedly so, for the level of work they were looking for. But when I got the job at Marvel, it was in the manufacturing department, and that's not where I wanted to be, but I just wanted to get my foot in the door. And 4 months later, the guy who got the job instead of me in 1983, Steve Saffel, was looking to hire an assistant, and he was in the promotions department. And I thought, okay, that's where I want to be. And I interviewed for the job of being his assistant, and he didn't know at the time that he was getting a boss hired over him to be a director of promotions and advertising for the company, start and literally build a department from the ground up. So I got hired as Steve's assistant, but I ended up being Mark Erickson's assistant less than a month later. And after a year, Mark decided Steve's responsibilities were going to be as promotion manager, doing all the conventions and all the retail and fan journal stuff and all that. And my job was going to be advertising manager. I was going to be responsible for all of Marvel's house ads, promotional posters, giveaway stuff, sell sheets, co-op ads, all the things we were doing back then. And that's what I started to do. So by 1987, I was Marvel's advertising manager. I was getting to do what I went to college for at Marvel Comics, which was pretty freaking cool. And both a combination of incredible good luck and incredible hard work too. Because the advertising manager job was a tremendous amount of work. And that's basically how I started to get my foot in the door into editorial, because my advertising job required me to work with all the editors in the company and also the licensing department, the international publishing department, direct sales, newsstand sales, pretty much everyone in the company. My job responsibilities basically got me to put my finger in the pie of every single department in that company, and all of it was completely to my benefit that was the case, because my star kind of went up in the company quickly because a lot of people were getting to know me, and I was producing solid work on a regular basis under really tight deadlines and producing a lot of work too. But our sales were continuing to go up as a result of a lot of people's efforts, not just my own. But our ads were better, our posters were better, our direct market response was better, sales were going up. So between 88 and 91-ish, when I was an advertising manager from 87 to 90, 91. Those years were incredibly successful years for Marvel from a publishing revenue standpoint. And I was, I was one of the reasons, but I was part of a whole group of people that were all working very well together, as the company came together really, really well in the late 80s.
Yeah, it makes sense now that you give that little bit of history, because you end up, I mean, I wanted to get to this later, but it makes sense to do it now. You end up working on the top selling IP when you get to the X offices, when you now are writing. And during that time, part of the, what people remember about those comics is all of the kind of the perks and the bonuses that come with buying those comics. You get the cards, you get the chromium cover. Did your experience in the advertising department have something to do with the way that those things were formatted, or was that out of
No, because by the time I was writing X-Men, I was already out of promotion and advertising, and I was an editor. Right. I didn't start really writing on X-Books until 92, I think it was. I was writing New Warriors. I was actually advertising manager when New Warriors number one came out, and my job was to create the advertising promotional program for New Warriors. But you know, I wanted to put 90% of the yearly budget into one title, New Warriors, but others told me that that wouldn't be appropriate. But by the time I think I was writing X-Men, I was already out of promo. I'm almost positive, because I don't remember doing any of the ads for the X-Men number one relaunches and all that stuff. And I don't remember doing any advertising for my own X-Force number one launch. So what the advertising job did is it helped me form really good relationships with all the editors. It made them understand that I was a writer who could write the book for them on time, and it would be of serviceable enough quality that they could publish it without feeling embarrassed. But I also understood what it took to sell a book. So I knew how to help them with their sales promo blurb for the direct market catalogs, that I knew how to come up with cover ideas
right.
that were going to be strong and visual. My job wasn't the specialty covers or that kind of stuff. That was actually the marketing department. That was a guy named Sven Larsson who came up with that whole program. And it kind of steamrolled out of his control, but his original program ideas were really, really fun and cool. And it was going to be a hell of a lot less than it ended up being. It was like everything we did back then, it was a victim of its own success, because we were owned by people who were incredibly greedy and had no real interest in the long-term health of the company. They just wanted short-term revenue. So that's why we went from a program idea that was going to be four specialty covers a year to the point where it was becoming four specialty covers a month.
Right.
So that wasn't me, though. That wasn't my part of the gig.
Right. See, I was thinking more in terms of your experience of knowing how to advertise for the books that would have been coming out when you were in that managerial position. Now that you're the writer, it's almost like I know what will make this book also be more of a seller, having been on
that,
the other side.
I would say that was to my benefit with New Warriors, and even when I did 1 year of Alpha Flight, quite a bit more than it was with the X-Books, because the X-Books were really strong on their own,
right?
And they got even stronger as the influx of all that hot new art talent was coming into it. They right. got even stronger as a result of the relaunches. They got even stronger as a result of the cartoon being on air. So even sure. after all the Image guys left, our sales were still top notch and increasing, actually, compared to the average of what they were doing monthly before that. My promo experience didn't benefit those books nearly as much. The editor, Bob Harris, had a very good handle on what was working and what the audience wanted. But certainly with New Warriors, Alpha Flight, you know, I applied aspects of that to trying to come up with stories that were going to generate interest among the fan press, the direct market, and the audience itself. And it worked on both those books, actually. My 1 year tenure on Alpha Flight, the sales went up quite significantly, and New Warriors was a big success, especially in comparison to what people expected it was going to be. It was a top 25 book, and it doubled in sales almost from issue number one to issue number 14 or 13 or so.
That doesn't happen.
So I would definitely say that I was doing things right on those books. But let's put it in perspective. At the same time as I was writing Marvel's number one book, I was also writing Nomad, which was Marvel's second lowest selling book. Okay, so not everything is easy, and not everything you touch turns to gold.
Sure. Well, I've heard you say that your time on New Warriors is one of your favorite things you've ever worked on, having collaborated with Mark Bagley and Derek Robertson, but also, I mean, later on you would reunite with Mark Bagley on Thunderbolts. What made New Warriors so much fun for you?
As much as anything, it was a combination of opportunity and success. Mm-hmm. Those two things are great when they go hand in hand. When you get the opportunity to do something that you really feel strongly you can do right, and then you do it right and the audience reacts positively to it, that's a really good feeling. because you're working in simpatico with an artist on a monthly basis. You're both clicking and in sync. He knows what you're looking to do, and you know what he is best at doing and strongest at doing. So Mark and I were just a very good team for that 2 year period. Derek and I thought we're a very good team also for a 2 year period. My themes just got a little darker during Derek's time and a little more emotive because a strength of his was drawing character interaction and emotion. Mark's strengths were really storytelling and action more so at that time. So I gave Mark bigger, bolder, stronger things to do in that capacity, and I gave Derek more gut-wrenching emotional stories to do, which automatically meant that they were a little darker and a little more dramatic. So I think the tone and tenor of the book changed and shifted slightly from, you know, the first 25 issues to the second 25 issues, but I wouldn't trade any of that, you know, any of those 50 issues for anything. It was a great experience. So quite honestly, when your first issue sells 126,000 copies in the direct market and your 12th issue sells 250,000 copies in the direct market, you're doing something right. And that's a great feeling, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I hope sometime in the future, because we live in that day and age where everything gets recollected, and I know they've done certain collections of New Warriors, but it would be nice for them to re-release it in a more easily attainable format to read it, because I've seen it, you know, here and there, but always kind of in patches, or there's the big omnibus.
Yeah, there's the 25 issues in the omnibus. There's a couple trade paperbacks of some of the Derek stuff I think I did. They do that stuff if there's A, a market for it, or B, a marketing reason for it. So right. If there had been a New Warriors TV show or whatever, they would have released the whole 75 issue run in multiple epic collections or something like that. At the end of the day, they're going to do what they know they can sell. So if they're not doing it, it's not because they don't like it. It's just because they don't think it's going to sell.
Right.
And I get that. I understand it. I wouldn't mind having the whole thing collected, but I got enough of it in hardcover or in trade paperback that I can live. I can survive.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind a few epic collections. I don't know how many books they collect in those epic collections, but they could probably do the whole 75 issue run in just a certain, you know, like how many would that take? 4 or 5 volumes?
It would probably take 4, because I think an epic collection can hold up to 20 issues, roughly 500 pages.
Yeah, then they could do it in 4 easily.
Yeah.
That would be cool. That would be cool if they ever did that, but... Yeah. I gotta be honest with you, Eric. I'm getting older, and I'm caring a lot less about that kind of stuff. my mind, and my interests have really gravitated away from worrying that much about comics. So I try not to even think too much about that kind of stuff. You know,
yeah.
I 9 times out of 10, I don't even know when they're doing a trade paperback or a hardcover of my stuff anymore. I don't know until I get a mailbox package with 2 copies of it or something. I'm like, oh, they did this. Oh, okay. You know, and it goes on a shelf. You know.
Right. Well, it's always cool to see that your stuff is living on as well. It's not something that a lot of the books that you've done are very celebrated and a lot of people's favorites. So it's eventually going to come back around.
Yeah, right? It's one benefit of your vocal, whiny man boy audience being in their late 30s, early 40s, because that means they were 12, 13 years old when they were buying all Marvel comics in the early 90s. And that means that they were buying a bunch of my books because I was writing so many of them.
Yeah.
So mathematically speaking, odds are pretty good that they're going to keep reprinting those books because that audience is there for it. And I see so many people at conventions. I want to introduce you to my 10-year-old son. I was his age when I first bought this comic and I wanted him to see you sign it. And I'm like, okay, thank you. You're telling your son that I'm old. That's what you're telling him. So it's really nice though. And I get it. And for all the whining and complaining that everyone always does about how awful the 90s were, they were so awful that they need to continue to reprint this stuff again and again and again, just to remind everyone of how bad they were. That's why Marvel does it, because they just want to remind you of how bad the 90s were, not because they keep making money off of this stuff. So Marvel's been making money off of the work we did for 30 years is what it amounts to.
You know what? I was just thinking about that in the last couple of weeks about – I was a lapsed comic book collector and reader, and when I got back into it – growing up, I was a – as a kid, I was reading Superman because if I had a little bit of money, that was the first character that I remember as a kid, so I'd buy Superman comics. So when I got back into it and I would ask people, you know, what should I read from the 90s if I want to get into this? Like, everything from the 90s is, you know, they have that snobby sort of attitude. And it's like, that's going away now because now people are, all those people who were kids in the 90s are like me. They're the podcasters who love that stuff. Who look back at it, and it's what made us fall in love with all of this in the first place. And a lot of those stories, when you take away the snobbery that we think we have now with this indie sort of movement, those stories are still great. They hold up. It's just a product of its time, the way Stan Lee's verbose style was a product of its time.
Yep, absolutely. And the irony is that the people who most decried that work back then were the ones who are now, who were the age back then, as the people who are of age now decrying any indie styles or SJW crap and all that. It's the same age that does it, the same age that complains that these comics aren't like my comics. So the early 90s, we were specifically and purposefully doing slightly more bombastic comics or completely more bombastic comics because our audience had gotten younger, not older. Right. Especially on the X-Books. So the older audience that had been working, who had been reading the X-Men through the 70s from the beginning, they're the ones who resented it the most. The guys who grew up reading Stan Lee's Silver Age and Roy Thomas's Silver Age Marvel comics but were now in their late 30s, early 40s, and had gone through the whole first comics phase and Fantagraphics phase and Love and Rockets and all that stuff, they were hating on what we were doing because it wasn't respectful of the Silver Age stuff. They were children when they read originally, right? And it, all of it is not taking into account that we were doing exactly what we were supposed to be doing. We were appealing to the majority of our audience. And that's your job. And when you're doing mainstream monthly superhero comics for the big two, your job is to make your audience enjoy it. Period. Like, so I'm still to this day, 30 years later, incredibly curious to understand exactly what is the problem in making a comic that your reader likes. And you got to pretty much figure they like it if they're buying it at the numbers they were buying it consistently on a monthly basis, you know?
Yeah.
So I just always shrug my shoulders. I shrugged my shoulders back then and said, whatever, we're selling 750,000 effing copies. I don't care, you know? And now I shrug my shoulder even more because the irony is the guy, half the guys who grew up reading my comics are now the guys who are complaining about the comics that are being put out today. Right. And it's no different than the guys who were complaining about the comics you were reading when you were 12 years old. So
right.
It's ironic in that the cycle always repeats itself.
Yeah, it's true. And you know what? For everybody who might criticize that, you know, that changing of the guard, as it were, a lot of the stuff that you and Scott and that team did is amongst some of the best X-Men work, considering that it follows Chris Claremont, right? So Age of Apocalypse, most people, whenever they talk about it, 90% of the time, it's one of the best X-Men stories. So it is what it is. The X-Men were good in the 90s. At least the X-Men were still good, right?
If the audience remembers it fondly, that's great. Yeah. That's the most you can want. I remember very, very fondly reading a lot of stuff from the 70s, and sometimes I'll reread it in Marvel Masterworks versions, and they hold up beautifully, and I still love it. And other times I read what I thought I loved back then and go, hey, it wasn't that good.
Yeah,
that wasn't too good. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. The only thing I collect anymore are Marvel Masterworks, and I like having them because I like having the run of books without having to worry about having comic books. So right now I'm reading the Marvel Masterworks, Jerry Conway and Gil Kane and Ross Andrew, when the volume where Gwen Stacy dies. And it's just incredible to me how those first four or five issues, you know, hold up to this day. The yeah. things Jerry Conway was doing as such a young writer still resonate 50 years later. So, yes, I do think Age of Apocalypse and Executioner's Song and those things are going to still resonate for another 20 years with an audience. I think there'll still be an audience that'll be curious about those books because they did big things and they were exciting comics. 100%. And they clearly resonated with a huge chunk of the audience because they still consider them to this day as very important comics in their collections.
Yeah, 100%. How did you, in regards to the actual writing of that book, when a person has had something for 15 years, kind of putting their vision into it in regards to Claremont, and now you take over this book that has, you know, been beloved by so many people, how do you transition now to giving it your voice without it being jarring to what people had been accustomed to?
I think one of the things that helped, I wanted to just write it. I really did. I did not want to try to write it like Chris because I don't write like Chris.
Right.
And there was a lot of Chris's peccadilloes in his writing that had lost me at that point. And this is saying as someone who's read Chris's work since the early 70s in the black and white magazines, in X-Men, in Marvel Team Up. I mean, I loved Chris as a writer and I love Chris as a person, period, now. But by the time I was already in my 20s, he had lost me on the X-Men. So by the time I get to write it when I'm 29, 30, I'm not worried about emulating Chris. I'm worried about bringing a level of energy and excitement to the book that I thought it had been lacking, and bringing a level of consistency and completion to the storylines that I thought the book had been lacking. I was able to do one of those two things. I was able to bring energy and some exciting story concepts along with Scott and Bob to the books, but I was not able to create storylines that allowed us to resolve and move on because the editor wouldn't allow us to do that. It just was not in his DNA. He was terrified of solving the mystery. And as a result, all he ever did is make us compound on the mystery and nothing ever gets solved. And it all got more and more confusing. So the combination of my plotting approach being very different than Chris's, the editor's strong hand in the books, because he was a strong editor that had a strong line, so he had the right to be the way he was. Those things really kind of ran counter to my writing style and my ability to write the book well. The dialogue was difficult because I tried to be far more dramatic and flowery than I would prefer to be, and the editor had a heavy hand in rewriting script, so it ended up becoming even more flowery and more overwrought than I wanted it to be, taking into account I was already being more dramatic and overwrought than I wanted to be.
Right.
So it was almost like it was like a double stuff Oreo. It was twice the amount of bad white crap for you inside. So I was pretty unhappy with my writing on X-Men almost from the get-go, just within the first four or five issues. I already knew that it was not going to be a working experience that was going to be playing to my strengths. I knew that it wasn't going to be a writing experience like New Warriors was. I had a little bit of a freer hand in X-Force after Rob left. I got to do a little more of what I wanted to do, and that was a more comfortable experience, and working with Greg Capullo was great, but X-Men was always a chore. It was a grind every single month. It was not a fun book to work on ever. And I've said it plenty of times. The truth of the matter is, I stayed on the book as long as I did because the money was just too damn good, and writing the number one selling book was too good for my career. So I continued to just let it go as long as I could until I couldn't do it anymore, and I quit. Nothing to be proud of or nothing to be noble about, because you know it took me 3 years to quit, and I should have probably quit within the first 5-6 issues. Like other writers had done, you know. Who was the one who quit? Was it Peter David who quit X Factor? I think he did. I think Peter David quit X Factor pretty quickly because he saw that it wasn't it wasn't going to be a happy working experience for him. Mm-hmm. Did he even write X Factor for a year before DeMatteis took over? I don't remember.
Sure. I think
he so. Did. So anyway.
Okay, so let's move away from the X-Men, but just before we do, what are your three favorite things that you actually got to do on it? If you could look back and say, these are three things that I'm proud of.
On X-Men?
Right? Yeah. It could be one story, it could be, you know, the execution.
The issue 19 of X-Force with Xavier having a problem with the X-Force, the young X-Force characters. I was very happy with that issue. I was very happy with the wedding of Scott and Jean.
Yeah.
I was glad we got to do it, and I thought we did it well. I was happy with the Magneto Wolverine issue 25 sure. because we did something really, really big and bold, and it played out for many years rather than just a couple months. I like being not. It wasn't my idea to do it. It was my issue to do it in, and I like the opportunity to do something so dramatic that still resonates to this day.
Yeah, I would agree with those picks. They're definitely up there in everybody's memory of big moments that you had on the book. So let's talk about something that was perhaps a happier time. I could be wrong, but I think it was. And speaking of re-released and collected things, The Adventures of Captain America that you did with Kevin Maguire.
happier times. What are you, crazy?
No, okay.
That was a nightmare. Nightmare. Everything that could have gone right working on that for the first issue or two went completely wrong after that. I mean, Kevin's been my friend for 30 years. We were roommates and we were friends. And Tom DeFalco basically asked me, what's it going to take to get Kevin over here? Because Tom loved Kevin's work and he was really frustrated that Kevin had been a Romita Raider and left us to go draw Justice League for DC. He was offered Silver Surfer at the same time, and I actually recommended to Kevin that he do Justice League. That was my advice to him. And Tom wanted him back, so Kevin and I talked about what would it take to get you to come back, and he wanted to do a period piece for Captain America. He wanted to do Captain America, and Tom said, perfect, because the 50th anniversary is coming up. That'll be great. But Kevin wanted to do it as a period piece. He wanted to do it set in World War II, and I didn't want to do that at first. And it was almost like a caveat. Nobody ever stated it, but it was always understood that if I'm getting Kevin to come back to Marvel, then I'm going to get to write whatever it is, and Kevin and I are going to work together. And the way Kevin and I work, it's not like I'm writing it. You know, we're coming up with the entire story ourselves together. He's contributing 50% or more to the story, and he's also contributing, you know, snippets of dialogue here and there to convey the emotion or the thought that he's trying to draw. He didn't write dialogue back then, but he certainly provided plenty of fodder for the dialogue. So we're storytellers, and that's how we tried to credit ourselves all the time together. Mm-hmm. He wanted to do a period piece. He wanted to do Captain America the movie before there was a movie. That's what he wanted, it to be the movie. This is the movie we would make if we were making a Captain America movie. He just got into a very dark, depressive place regarding his inability to let go of the work. And it affected everything. It affected the schedule of the book, the ability to produce the work. It affected our relationship a little bit because I was caught between a rock and a hard place because I have to represent the company to a certain extent. I'm the advertising manager, and I have X amount of thousands of dollars budgeted for Cap's 50th anniversary, and part of that is this project, and I'm realizing this project's not going to come out. So what am I doing with the budgeted money? All that kind of stuff, you know, all of that business mixed with art gets kind of muddled together. And I felt very bad for Kevin because he's my really good friend, but we're talking about a guy that got to the point where he was ripping up absolutely beautiful completed pages because he didn't think it was good enough. And when I tell you, trust me, they were good enough. They were good enough. Doesn't even come close to describing how great they were. It just became impossible for him to finish the book. And we missed Captain America's 50th anniversary. We blew by that deadline. We were facing it being almost 1, 2, 3 years late on the schedule. And he had the project had to be pulled from him when he was in the middle of the third issue. So none of that was pleasant. None of that was fun. I just reread it when they put it in a trade paperback finally. So I just reread it for the first time in 20 something years. And to me, I love the first 2.5 issues. And then after that, it kind of falls apart for me because as valiantly as Kevin West and Steve Carr tried to finish that story, as valiantly as they tried to emulate this tone a little bit in style, it just wasn't going to be the same thing because they were drawing off of a relatively rough plot because I never fully plotted knowing Kevin and I were going to break it all down anyway, you know? So it was a struggle to do that series, and it was very difficult, and it never came out with the impact and emphasis that it should have had, and it'll never be remembered 25, 50 years later is like the definitive origin of Captain America, like it could have. They drew a tremendous amount of story material out of it for the first Captain America movie.
I was going to say that. When I read it, I'm like, this definitely feels like they took a lot out of from the movie, from this book.
Yeah, they did. And they admitted, the art director admitted how much he took from Kevin's style for the thing. There was a bunch of scenes that were not lifted from our story, but inspired by our story.
Definitely.
A whole bunch of stuff. I mean, the fact Kevin and I saw it together in the theater, and the fact that they didn't give us credit in the closing credits under their thank you block was really, really disappointing. So in essence, the movie even put a cherry on top of the sundae that was the odd, strange love-hate relationship with that, you know, with that project.
Well, I'm so sorry to have brought it up, but I really love this book.
And always okay to talk about. that one's no problem to talk about just because I like talking about it because it shows an audience the challenges that can happen while you're working on a project that there's, and the good can still come out of those challenges. You know, you're not always going to be happy with what the work is. And often there's many, many reasons for that. And it's good to understand that and know that, because a lot of people tend to read this stuff and they separate the reality of human beings making it. Almost like you watch a sports event and you separate the reality of the fact that they're human beings who are going to make mistakes, you know, while you're watching the sporting event or something. You can't tolerate they're making a mistake. The same thing goes into the creative process with comic books. You're not always going to get it right, or it's not always going to be a smooth, happy-go-lucky, fun, you know, fake Stan Lee 1966 yeah. bullpen bulletins kind of,
right.
We're all in this together, let's hold hands and create comic books kind of thing. It's not always like that.
Right, absolutely. Well, it says something, though, that it was recollected in one of the Epic collections that had recently come out, and then they put it in its own trade all on its own. And when you read the reviews for that particular Epic collection, they say that it's worth getting just for that portion of the book that is you and Fabian. So it says a lot about the work that you guys did. So as much as
I think the first two issues were terrific. I was really, really happy when I'm reading it. I'm going to the entire cadence of the dialogue, pace, the tone was very, very progressive for Marvel back then and very different. A lot of that comes out of what Kevin supplies on the art. That just is so inspiring to write dialogue to that. But I was writing and scripting in a way that I hadn't been able to on some of my other work, and a lot of that was because of the art Kevin was giving me. But I was very, very satisfied with that whole project up to the point where it wasn't going to be finished the way that we had wanted it to be originally, you know?
Right. Well, I appreciated it, and I'm happy that I got to read it. So thank you guys for doing that. How about is Cable and Deadpool a happy thing to talk about?
It was one of the three best writing experiences of my career. It was great to get to write those two characters and be completely left alone. It was just me and my artists and poor editor Nicole Boos, I keep forgetting, did she start as Nicole Wiley and then became Nicole Boos, or did she start as Nicole Boos and then she became Nicole Wiley? I always get it confused. She got married while she was editing the book. This poor young kid editor gets assigned to this book with me as the writer, God forbid, and two characters that Marvel could care less about at that point. They were just trying to reclaim them after Agent X and Soldier X hadn't performed for them the way they hoped that they were gonna when they rebooted it. And Gale's Agent X book was a lot of fun, but it wasn't Deadpool. And I think Marvel underestimated the fact that those two characters had fans. They just weren't servicing those fans by the way they were doing the characters. So when they hired me to do Cable and Deadpool, it was almost a desperation thing. I hadn't, on both our parts, because I hadn't written anything for Marvel in 6 months at the time that they called me, and I didn't know that I was going to get a chance to again, because the new president was Bill Jemison. I don't think he thought of me as a writer that he wanted to have working for them. And when they asked me to do it, it was basically, do you think we could do a book with these two guys together? Your name came up in the meeting as someone who knows these characters. And I go, yeah, of course you can do a book with them together. And they hung up the phone. I looked out the window of my office in my old home. And I go, how the hell am I going to do a book with these two guys in it together? They're going to want to kill each other the minute they see each other. I go, okay, there's my first six issues. So that buys me some time to figure this out. And that's exactly what it was. The first six issues was just me buying time to figure it out. And I figured it out by the second arc. And once I figured it out, it was an incredibly smooth, fun book to do. The only challenges about that book were twofold. How do I get away with the three jokes that I know I want, and how do I get that past the legal department every month? And the second thing was, we were under a 6 month cancellation guillotine every 6 months. So every 6 months we were waiting to find out if we were going to be canceled or not, which affected some of the long term plotting ideas for the book. But I don't think it hurt the book in terms of its narrative, because it allowed me to almost reboot a little bit every 6 months, and not worry too much or think too much about where am I going to be status quo wise every 12 issue arcs, you know, issue 12, issue 25, issue 36, issue 50, where am I going to be? You know, I didn't have to think that way anymore because I didn't know if we would be published, you know, after 6 months. And that was true pretty much almost every step of the way from the very first six issues, every time we had to wait to hear if we were renewed for another six.
I was going to ask that actually, because I'm thinking to myself, this seems like a story from the very first arc where he knew exactly where he was going with this the whole time with the Cable storyline and how Deadpool plays into it. But I'm like, what was it? Did they know that they would have another 12 or another six? Was there a back door that you would have had planned in case you were?
Nope. That was one of the first times in my career that I ever wrote a book without either having on paper or knowing in my mind where I would be 3, 4, 5 years down the road. I really didn't. I wasn't only thinking 6 months ahead, because it's almost impossible to only think 6 months ahead. I know a lot of writers nowadays do, but I can't. But I wasn't worrying about it more than 12 issues at a time. So I knew specifically what my six issues were, I wanted to be. So knowing what that is, then you have a rough idea of how that folds into your next six. The thing about pacing and writing in monthly comics is it's not the 12 that you have to worry about, because you can break your 12 into easily understandable flows based on 4 to 6 issue turnarounds, right? The difficult thing about comics is understanding how that 12 issues is going to affect the next 12 issues, and that usually is a demarcation point in terms of fake marketing. Issue 25, issue 50, issue 75, issue 100, those are your 2-year marks. arcs every 2 years, every 24 issues. So you have to understand how your 12 informs your 25, how your 25 informs you up to 50. You know, so when you're long term plotting, that doesn't mean you have actually written the plots. It just means you have a rough understanding of how these 12 issue arcs become 25 issue milestones. You know, I didn't think that way at all with Deadpool, no, Cable and Deadpool. Like, not at all. I just let it just keep going. Let it keep going. Okay, then he goes to Remekistan. He wants his own country now because he couldn't take over the world. Okay, Deadpool's going to go kill him because no one trusts that he should be running his own country. Okay, you know, and that's pretty much how I plotted it. A lot of it also was, Patrick, what do you want to draw? I'd love to draw Power Man and Iron Fist. Yeah, they're not Power Man and Iron Fist anymore. I know, but can't we kind of make them that way for a while? Yeah, we can try. And Nicole Wiley just like, all right, let me find out if we can do it. And going to her bosses, and those bosses going, wow, we're still publishing a book called Cable and Deadpool? And she goes, no, we're not. And she'd run away. So we were off in a corner doing whatever we wanted. The only people who knew we were publishing that book for the most part were the lawyers in the company. Because they had something to complain about every single issue, and occasionally, if I went a little too far and made fun of something, or someone took offense to something I made fun of, as if I was intending a personal slight on them, I know that, you know, I know that there were a couple things. I did an Enema of the State story arc that they thought I was making fun of. What was going on in Wolverine, and I wasn't even reading what was going on in Wolverine. I just thought Enema of the State was a really funny title.
That's hilarious.
So that was it. It was that, you know. So it was a really, really enjoyable 50 issues. I got to have a lot of fun. I think the readers loved it. I think we had a really, really good, loyal audience. It wasn't a huge audience, but they were there for the whole 50-issue run. Our sales levels were never great, but they were consistent for 50 issues. We had about 34,000 readers. Those numbers would bump up a bit when we did a crossover, and that was enough to keep us going for the 6-issue cycles that we were getting renewed on, which is why I crossed over as much as I did, because I knew that just one or two issues of a crossover every 6 was going to give us the higher numbers we needed to get us to the next, the next approval for another 6 issues. And I liked it a lot. I was already planning to leave with 50 because I was negotiating an exclusive contract with DC. I also knew the handwriting was on the wall when they took Cable out of the book that they were going to cancel it. If I'd gotten to continue to write either one of them in their monthly books, I may not have signed the exclusive contract with DC, but they didn't offer me either one, and I shrugged my shoulders and said, okay, have a good either. Your characters, good luck. I have barely read any Deadpool comics that have come out since 2008, and I've read no Cable comics since I stopped writing it in 2008. You know, and that's not a detriment or a knock on any of the guys that are doing them, because there's a lot of really good writers doing them, and I know Jerry Dugan, and he's a really, really good writer. I just have only read a few of his issues when I needed to catch up on the status quo of something, you know? And I'm not going to read anybody else's Cable because I don't want to read anybody else's Cable. I personally feel that I'm the best writer that character's ever had, so I'm not that interested in reading what somebody else wants to do with them.
Well, I have to say, Cable and Deadpool were two characters that I had never really cared for myself, and people had always said, if you want to read a good Deadpool, there's two places you can look, that where it's not just the silly fourth wall breaking Deadpool necessarily, and it was X-Force, Uncanny X-Force from Remender, and Deadpool and Cable were always the two that were mentioned. So I gave Deadpool and Cable a chance, collected all three trades, and this is the last book that has had a very impactful effect on what I've been reading in the last few months, because things that you did with Cable, it completely opened my eyes to the potential of a character that I was ignoring. I did a little bit of history on a YouTube, fell into a YouTube hole on Cable, and I went back and read all of the X-Men stuff that led up to Executioner Song, and now I'm at Fatal Attractions. But it started because of what you did with Cable in this book. I thought it was incredible, and I wasn't expecting it.
I appreciate that. I'm pretty proud of the work. I'm pretty happy with the work. It's in my top 3, right? So I must be happy with it, with everything I've written. It's just one of those opportunities. You're writing two characters that you really like writing. You're forced to write them together, which doesn't make sense. So you have to find a way to make it make sense.
Right.
And in those first six issues, I found their commonality that made it a pleasure and easy for me to write. And that commonality was that both men are just incredibly lonely people. And their loneliness cries out of them, if you're paying attention.
Yeah.
So they had no one else to be with but each other. How frickin' sad is that? And how much fun can you have with that sadness? That's what it amounted to, you know?
Absolutely.
So that's basically how I approached the whole book. That these are two people that other people, anytime they try to be with them, it ends up being a miserable experience. So they try not to be with them. But they're both people that draw you back into their orbit again and again and again. It's no coincidence that a lot of the characters that float in and out of the orbits of both those characters to this day remain the same characters. There's a sense of loyalty between them and a sense of desperation that maybe this time it'll work out because I'd like it to work out. You know, the two of them kind of deserve to have something go right for them, you know, but it just never does. That's all. So that's why I like doing it. I knew who I wanted Cable to be. See, the thing is, Rob created Cable, and Rob had all these ideas about what he wanted him to be. I just never knew what most of them were because he never put anything down on paper. And when he told me about any of them, they were always very, very haphazard and sporadically orally delivered, right? And I'm not an oral guy. I'm not a listening guy. I need it on paper in order to concretize it in my mind. So because it wasn't there, I didn't worry too much about the things that he had thought about. I just knew what I inherited.
Right.
And what I inherited in my mind was a guy who had lost his entire life and was back here to try to prevent that from happening to other people. That's all. That's what I had. So that's how I always approached the character from the very first time I got to write him solo, which was the miniseries with JR. He's a guy who doesn't want it to happen again. Not to him. He doesn't want it to happen again to all the other people he's failed. You know, he's failed to save his world. He failed to save his family. He failed to stop a despot. He failed spectacularly after having fought his entire life. And he's a guy in his 50s, so it's not like he was a kid, you know? And he translates that to the present day by having an attitude that he can't get too close to people. He can't give of himself emotionally because he's failed so often that he can't do it anymore. But by the same token, he just drastically, desperately needs to not have it fail again, not have it happen again. You know, and that's a really, really interesting character to write when you're thinking of him that way. The problem is most writers don't think of him that way because they just don't understand him. They look at the surface stuff and they don't think that much about the other stuff, you know? They look at the time travel, but they don't look at the time he has spent in those travels, that kind of thing, you know?
Right.
So you know, that's why I don't want to read what other writers write of him, because I don't trust that any of them are going to understand him. Simple as it's as simply arrogant as that. I'm very comfortable with Cable more so than just about any other character, even Deadpool. There's plenty of guys who've written a really good Deadpool. A couple, I think, have written a better Deadpool than me. Not many, but a couple. But Cable, I don't think anyone else has ever written a better Cable, and I honestly don't know. I'm not 100% sure if anyone else will. I won't know because I won't have read it, but maybe I'll hear about it.
Right. Well, it's amazing how, even though it's a book that, you know, was started in 2004 and you use the pop culture references to make it of its time when you're reading the book, which is part of its humor and charm, there's that irreverent humor, but a lot of the themes in it and what you just explained and what Cable's trying to do and his concern not for the immediate future, he's saying, I'm worried about us 1,000 years from now. So if right now this is going to be tough, what I'm doing may be tough now, I want everything to be better way down the line. That's where I'm thinking. And a lot of, you know, in today's world, those themes are actually a lot of the dialogue, right? People are not just thinking immediate anymore. It's like, what about the planet 500 years from now? We got to do something about it today. So this book still has like a certain resonance, even with the humor and the lightheartedness that Deadpool brings to it. There's definitely themes that make you think more than I thought I was going to be thinking when I read this book. I'll be honest.
Well, one thing I've tried to carry over since my early New Warriors days is the running tagline that we had for that book was, "It's not going to suck like you thought it was going to." So I'll say that about Cable and Deadpool, too.
No,
it's not going to suck like you thought it. If you're a Cable hater or a Deadpool hater, you may not like Cable or Deadpool after you read this book, but I guarantee you're going to understand them better than you did before. That doesn't mean you're going to like the characters, because some people just don't like certain characters.
Sure.
But at least you're going to have been forced to have come up with a reason why you don't like them that isn't surface. He's a jerk and all he does is tell jokes. He's just a bunch of padding and guns. You know, now you got characters you got to consider and make your decision why you don't like them as a result of that. So, you know, it's good. And then one of my other favorite issues, you were asking me my favorite stuff from the X-Men days. One of my favorite issues was the issue with Captain America where you know, Captain America gets to see the perspective that Cable brings to this and how it's so much bigger than even he sees the scope of things, you know? And I found that to be a very enjoyable issue because I wanted to put in perspective the magnitude that is Cable and Cable's life experiences in comparison to a Marvel mainstream character who is considered to have a magnitude of experiences, Captain America, you know? And when he tells Captain America that he's a general, a president, and a pope all rolled into one, that's saying a lot. He's not just a captain. He's a lot more than that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That was a great issue. I really enjoyed that one specifically. Speaking of things that are timely and you know, unexpected for me anyways, was what you're working on now, which is Outrage on Webtoons. I read all 26 episodes. I don't know if you would count them as issues, but I read them all. And it had sort of that same experience that I had reading Deadpool and Cable, where you had this character who had, again, that humor whenever he shows up and causes a ruckus when he feels justice needs to be served. But there's that underlying theme of what's happening in the world today. Where did the concept for this come together with you and Riley Brown?
I always talk in my interviews that I don't think of myself as an idea man. Like, you know, Dan Slott's an idea man, and Scott Lobdell's an idea man. These guys rattle off 100 ideas a day. And even if 90 of them aren't worth developing, the 10 that are gold, right? I'm not an idea man. I don't come up with bits and hooks like that. And this, though, was an idea. The idea was really, really simple. You read someone's stupid comment online and you go, "I wish I could reach through that idiot's screen and smack the crap out of them." And literally, that was it. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, hey, what if I could reach through that idiot's screen and smack the crap out of him? What if someone could do that? Then what? And it just evolved from there. I had the idea. I had the name immediately. I was stunned a year later when I went to go do the trademark search that nobody had taken it. So we had the trademark available for Outrage. I called Riley up. We had lunch. I told him the idea. He loved the idea. He tells the story that he didn't realize I was giving him this idea with the desire that he would draw it. He just thought I was telling him what the idea I had. And then we ended up finding a place where we could do it, which was Webtoon. And it was the perfect place to do it because we both enjoyed working in digital comics. We thought a platform that is global in scope and has a really diverse audience base and has comment sections at the end of every chapter is the ideal place to do a story about a character that comes out of your phone and smacks the crap out of you, right? So it worked out really, really well. I'm really, really proud of the book. I think it's a very well-done book. I don't do a lot of comics anymore, so when I do them, I want to enjoy them. And the grind of the process, notwithstanding, because producing, you know, 6 pages a week every week for 26 straight weeks is not easy. And it beat the living crap out of the creative team, the artists. Not me, but the artists got got destroyed by the last few chapters, because we were dropping every week, and we're the only North American launch that they did, because they did a whole bunch of new North American launches in 2018. We were the only North American launch that came out every week for 26 consecutive weeks. Our audience base and our subscriber base acknowledges that, because we have almost 200,000 subscribers for Outrage, which means every week they get a notification that the new issue's up, and they, most of them go read it immediately, right? And it's really fun. It's a fun thing to do. We're working on season two now. It took a while to renegotiate our contracts. The business part of it took a while, and now we've started a lot more slowly than we should have on the penciling and the coloring end of it. But we're starting to build up the chapters. We got four chapters. We're working on four, you know, they keep going by chapters. I thought it was going to be season two, chapter one, and then I found out it's not. It's chapter 27, chapter 28, chapter 29. So as we speak right now, we're working on chapter 30, 31, and 32 in one level or another, right? So we have a few in the can already, in the drawer, but we need to have a lot in the drawer, because you eat up your time a lot on these weekly books. So we're probably not going to launch till we have at least 10 chapters in the drawer, and we're not quite there yet. So it's taken longer than any of us would have wanted. We were hoping to launch by November, and it's not going to be, I don't think, till January or early February, if I got to be honest. So that's a little frustrating, but the creative process is still tremendous fun. I'm still having a great time. Season two status quo shifts quite a bit. Yeah. The location is different. The situation is different for the lead character, Kenny Choi. The manifestation of Outrage is different. So I'm enjoying it, because it's a very natural extrapolation of everything that happened in the first season. Yeah. And we already know what the natural extrapolation for the third season will be if we get to do that, which I have a feeling we will if everything keeps going the way it's going, because we're relatively happy with Webtoon and they're relatively happy with us, so hopefully we'll be able to keep it going. So it's a lot of fun. It's like I said, if I'm not going to do comics that much, which I'm not, I want to like what I'm doing, and Outrage is a lot of fun, because I get to be really silly and stupid, but I get to make absolute commentary on the world around us and what's going on and who we are as a people. If you boil down the majority of my work in my career, it really boils down to a pretty simple theme. I think humanity is incredibly stupid, but I have hope for it yet. That's what it amounts to, you know? And Outrage is an absolute manifestation of that internal thematic statement I have, you know? The human beings are incredibly stupid, but I hope we'll get better. And everything I do kind of falls into that category in one way or another.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking as I was reading it, how the format affected the way that you would tell the story, because it doesn't read as a digital comic would on maybe another app. You scroll up and down with it. But then as I'm reading it and I'm thinking about the artwork, there's moments where you feel like you're looking at the exact same thing that a character in the story looks at on their device. It's just the face of Outrage talking to you. And I'm like, I get it. I don't know if that was on purpose, but
sometimes it is, yeah. Sometimes we want the reader to think that they're interacting with the story. I wish we could do more of that. I wish we could have more direct interaction to a certain extent, but it can't accommodate clickable links. It can't accommodate, leaving the story world and being able to come back into the story world. There's going to be a couple moments in the second season when we check in on Outrage being still trapped inside a phone, even though there are outrages out in the world, the real Outrage is still trapped in a phone. And we get to see that once in a while, which is going to be kind of cute, because it's a cutaway that acknowledges the situation the characters are in this world. I want to try to do it all in this particular book. I want to try to do it all in an entertaining manner rather than a didactic or heavy-handed manner. And I'm going to get a lot of conservatives who are going to complain that, you know, it's too, you know, anti-right leaning or biased. And my answer is going to be, well, you know, I'm indescribably anti-right. So the fact that it's only a little anti-right means I'm really working hard to try to balance it. Because if it were my personal druthers, Riley really tones me down in that regard. Riley's a lot more moderate than I am. If it were my personal druthers, I'd just be a eviscerating. I'd eviscerate the far left also, but not to the same extent that I eviscerate the far right, because I feel the far left is just unicorn stupid and the far right is evil stupid.
That's a good way to put it.
that's what I would do.
Yeah, no, and that was the thing, was I based on the Deadpool and Cable experience, I knew that there would be something special to look out for, but to really, when you leave a small little chapter that you get in these stories, and you left with something to really think about in regards to the language of technology and how we're interacting with it and it's affecting our behavior. Like, these things are not too far off from, in regards to our interaction with technology and these things being put into our devices to kind of have these effects on us. It really gets you thinking, especially because you're using your device to get this information. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Got this. Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And there's going to be a lot more of that in the second season, to tell you the truth, because a lot of the outrage comes out into the real world.
Yes.
And it's people deciding that they want to show their outrage in tribute to how outrage showed it, you know? And it kind of shows a bad light on them, and it shows a bad light on how government and corporate forces want to manipulate the outrage for their own benefits as well, you know?
Right. Yeah. No, it's a great story, and I highly recommend people to check it out.
I appreciate it. You can download Webtoon for free.
That's right.
Free app to download, or go to webtoon.com. Free to subscribe, free to read.
Awesome. Is there anything else that you're currently working on that we should be on the lookout for?
Yes, as a matter of fact, too much. It's been a wonderful fall for me. I am working on a project for the Big Two miniseries, but it hasn't been announced yet, so I can't talk about it. But it's a character I have written before, which isn't saying much, because if you look at my work on the Trinity weekly book, I've written just about every character at DC, and I've also written just about every character at Marvel, but it is a character I've written before. And it's a 5-issue miniseries that probably will come out in 2020, I expect. The artist is drawing the first issue now, and I am going to be starting my script on the fourth issue in about a week. It's fun. I got a call out of the blue unexpectedly in September from an editor asking would I be interested in a miniseries of this character, and my natural inclination lately when Marvel or DC calls me has usually been to say no, because it hasn't interested me, and they've called me for custom comics and short story stuff, and I just wasn't that interested, but this one definitely interested me because I really like the character, and I like the character status quo as a result of things that have been happening in the universe the comics exist in. So I said yes. Pending the editor liking my thoughts, my ideas, I said yes. And the editor liked it quite a bit, so we're off and running. I also got a great artist working on it, an artist I haven't gotten to work with before, I'm pretty sure, unless it was like a fill-in issue or something. But he's a fantastic artist, and I'm really happy to have him on the project. But I can't say what it is yet, because Marvel doesn't want to announce things. Whoops, I said which company it is.
Oh, I was going to say, oh, we know which company it's with. Okay.
Marvel doesn't want to announce it until they're ready. So sometime, I guess they'll announce it sometime in the next few months. I don't know. That is it in comics right now. I've been working on an animated pilot script for an animation company in LA for months on and off, and I guess I'm still supposed to be working on that. It's like, you know, do work on it and then not hear from them for months and then do work on it, so I don't know where we stand on that. And the majority of my writing stuff the last year or two has really been focused on trying to write a book manuscript, start and finish a book that I wanted to write. I'd wanted to do it for a long, long time, and I never had the confidence to do it. And I finally just barreled through and did it. And a lot has been happening this fall in regards to that manuscript. A tremendous amount of activity has been happening around the last couple of weeks, and I can't say anything more than that, but maybe there'll be a book by me somewhere in the future. And that's something I'd wanted to do in my career. And I'm glad that as I'm getting closer to 60, I'm glad that I'm going to be able to prove you can teach an old dog new tricks.
So a 14-year-old you would be able to look at the back of that book and be like, okay, I'm old enough now to have...
Yes, yeah. I told you the writers were all old. I told you. Yeah, except I'm twice as old as I thought those writers were. I think Stephen King was like in his mid-early 30s when I was reading his books in the 70s, and I thought that was old for crying out loud.
It doesn't matter. You made it. That's the point, is you ended up fulfilling those all those dreams you had. You ended up doing it.
Yeah, if I get a book published, it's going to feel good. I wasn't doing it for the money because books don't usually pay. I was doing it because I just really wanted to try to do it. I wanted to try to prove that I could do it, and hopefully it'll be good. And hopefully someone may be willing to buy it. Maybe it'll be a paperback book. It's a mystery novel, but it's different, a little different, because it's not so much a whodunit, it's a why done it. And it's I call it a sarcastic suburban mystery. You talk about all the real world elements I fold into my stuff. This is all thematically, it's all about white flight and white fear and racial prejudice and cultural change in small towns and in suburbia and the monotony of suburbia. And it's all of that couched within the context of a murder mystery. And it's a book I've wanted to write since 1993, I think, is when I had the title, the characters, and the idea. And I finally did it. And the reaction from people who were reading it for me and a freelance editor I hired continued to be strong. And I just kept chopping at it and cutting it because my manuscript was way too long. And then I got an agent, and the agent really, really liked it. And the agent sent it out to publishers, and a lot of publishers responded very positively. I was surprised as all get out, and it just kept going from there. So the last few months have been tremendously interesting, and the last few weeks have been ridiculously exciting. The book is going to be real. I can say that. I don't care that I'm saying it. I'm not saying what it is or who it's with or anything like that. I am saying that that I wrote a book and it's going to be real. So that's pretty freaking cool. And because this one is going to be real, that means I'm going to have to work on another one too. So that's going to be taking up a majority of my 2020.
There you go. Well, I think that's the best way to end it, on a high note. So thank you so much for
my giving pleasure, so Eric. Much thank you time. Very much. It was really an enjoyable talk.
Yeah, and next time, if we can, maybe a year or two, I'll have read your other two favorite things, the New Warriors and the Thunderbolts run that you did, because those are on my list of two reads. So maybe next time we'll talk about the fun you had making those books.
They're both very different, but they're both very synonymous of if I can do anything good, those two books reflect what I can do good. I'm very proud of both books for different reasons. And if you like reading any of my work, I think you're going to get a lot of good stuff out of those.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much again, Fabian.
Thank you. Time. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Now, get out of that cave of solitude.
Go Jets.
Go Jets. Yeah, right. It's 28-7. They've already had a fumble on like the Ravens 30. They had an interception at like the Ravens 5. They had a 4th-and-goal and they didn't make it. So they've left points on the table because they've had opportunity to have more points.
Yeah.
It should be a closer game than it is.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Well,
that's all right. They're the Jets, man. I've been doing this for so long, long time.
Is it? Are you Yankees or Mets?
One of my earliest memories of the Jets was, I think, in 1971, 2 years after the Super Bowl. I would think I was 10 or not even 10 yet. Exhibition season, 4th exhibition game or 6th exhibition game, like the last exhibition game against the Detroit Lions. Joe Namath throws an interception and he runs to go tackle the guy who intercepted the ball, and he breaks his leg tackling the guy. Oh. He's out for the season. And I thought to myself, huh, this is what it's going to be like to be a Jets fan. And it's been true for the rest of my life.
Well, are you a Yankee or Mets fan?
Yankee fan. I'm a Yankee fan. I'm a weird one. Usually, because I lived in Queens, you normally would have gravitated Mets-Jets, but I wasn't aware of baseball until I'd already moved out to New Jersey. Football I was aware of because Joe Namath was everywhere back in New York at that time. He was omnipresent. He was huge. And my mom loved Joe Namath. She thought he was the coolest thing in the world. Thought he was stylishly European. She didn't even know he was from Alabama, or Pennsylvania. He was from Pennsylvania, but he went to college in Alabama. So I became a Jets fan just because of her interest in Joe Namath and the Jets, right? I didn't become a baseball fan until I was probably 9 years old or so, 10. I was already out in Jersey, and I started to watch the Yankees, not the Mets. Even though the Mets were 1 year off from winning a World Series, I started watching the Yankees, and I just started watching the Yankees, and that was it. I became a Yankee fan. I didn't even realize at the time that a lot of our area fans gravitated in pockets. Most fans are Giants, Yankees, and Jets, Mets, and I kind of crossed streams there a little bit.
Well, at least you got some good memories with the Yankees, right?
Oh, please. A lot. I went to the clinching game of the World Series against the Mets a decade or 15 years ago or whatever. I go to about 4 or 5 games a year, actually. My wife is totally into it now, which is great. So I get to go see baseball games with her, and she's excited about it.
That's great. Well, thank you again, Fabian. You have yourself
Thanks,
a great night, and we'll talk again hopefully soon in the future.
Anytime. Thanks a lot. Have a good night.
You too.